Hey there, thank you so much for listening to our Big Time Talker podcast. We're everywhere now, Spotify, iHeartRadio, Blog Talk Radio, Apple iTunes, wherever you can subscribe to your podcast. And that's thanks to our friends at SpeakerMatch.com. They sponsor the show. SpeakerMatch is the world's largest online virtual speakers bureau. So as speaking events come back, if you're a platform speaker, maybe you're a meeting planner and you need a speaker, you can find one another at the virtual marketplace at SpeakerMatch.com. When you talk entertainment, you automatically think Las Vegas. And when you think entertainment in Las Vegas, if you're in the know, if you're an insider in that industry, you think about our guest today. Mark Prowse has spent almost four decades in and around the entertainment business in Las Vegas. He has an incredible new entertainment hybrid opportunity to help you stay connected and charged up. And we're going to talk about that as well with his new venture, Mark Prowse. Let's talk entertainment in Las Vegas. You grew up in that city. You're one of the few locals that actually is from Las Vegas, right?
Well, I guess the true locals would probably be offended by that, because a lot of locals would be born here and then they would not leave, right? And so what happened with me is I was actually born here, and then I left several times and realized the value of Las Vegas, and it really always felt like home. And so I came back a few different times. So I'm a local.
So people, you know, fly in and out of that city, and they go to shows and they go to conventions and they gamble and they have fun. But there's a whole lot of people that live in that city. And of course, way more than when you were a kid. So take me back to the Las Vegas of your youth. What was it like growing up in that city?
Well, my grandparents actually lived here, and we lived outside of town in a small town outside of Overton, kind of near Mesquite, if anybody knows that territory. So my earliest memories were coming to see my grandparents and coming in over the top of what we now call Apex at the top of the hill. And you could see this bright light, and it was just so surreal as a child. You know, we had five kids in the family, and we were all in a station wagon, and we'd all cuddle to the front seat. And as we come over the hill to see the bright lights of Vegas, and really the bright lights of Vegas then were Fremont Street. There's really nothing else to it. I mean, my dad was a big adventurer, so we would drive for what seemed like to a child hours to get to the Hoover Dam, which now it's all connected. You know, I mean, Boulder City has a little bit of a gap in there, but not much. And it goes all the way out into Boulder City and so on and so forth. So the metropolis that it is now with 2 million people, and, you know, people have made a lot of money in buying desert, you know, sitting out in the middle of nowhere that is now encompassed in parts of the city. And it's pretty interesting to see the growth of the city. But to your point, it does take a small army to support all of the things that happen here in Las Vegas. And that's the reason for the astronomical growth.
Mark Prowse is one of the leading entertainment executives for decades in Las Vegas. We're going to talk to him about some of the celebrities he's rubbed up against and some of the crazy things that you see in that city. But I am fascinated a little bit by kids that grow up there. I, as you know, worked and lived in Las Vegas in the late 90s for a few years. And one of the guys I worked with was also born there. And he said that as a young guy in the 1950s, I think there were 10 to 12,000 people in that city. So was it, did it feel like a big city to you as a little kid? What did it feel like?
Well, of course, as a child, I mean, Las Vegas is surreal. I mean, I mentioned the lights and those kind of things, but it was a place where I think what I got bit by the most that really steered my career more than anything too was it was a fun place. It was a fun business. You know, it was a place where you went to like leave your worries behind. And I don't know if you're a gambler, probably create new worries. But at the end of the day, it's for a child. It was just so surreal. It was like I lived in this Disney-esque kind of town that in the area. And that's really what brought me back. I think that what you also get addicted to is the 24-hour part of everything. Whenever I go move somewhere else or live somewhere else or wherever I would travel, and it's still frustrating to me that they roll the streets up, you know, and you can't go get groceries when you want. Here, it's just like you don't think about it.
You can get anything you want at any time.
Pretty much. I mean, you may have to travel a little bit farther, but not not outside the city or not nowhere at all. I mean, you can get pretty much anything you want.
Yeah, for good or for bad.
That's true.
And what year did you graduate from high school?
76. That was a big bicentennial year. So
that was a big year. A lot happening in the country. Yeah. And I'm sure Las Vegas probably put on a big show in 1976. Do you remember fireworks and centennial celebrations and all that?
Well, that was one of the times that I was not in Las Vegas, oddly enough. I graduated from Madison High School in Rexburg, Idaho. So my parents had moved us to Texas. That's where a lot of my formative years were. Then they moved us up to Idaho, and that's where I graduated from high school. And then, ended up graduating from the University of Wyoming. And then I came, went on my entertainment journey and ended up back here in Vegas a couple of different times. So.
And five kids, the only one that did entertainment?
Say again?
Were you the only one of the five kids that wound up in the entertainment business of your siblings?
Yeah. There was five kids, two brothers and two sisters. My two brothers are both within the petroleum industry. One of them was an engineer, and my two sisters are, entrepreneurs and that kind of stuff. So they totally different businesses, totally different disciplines, all very, very successful in their realms.
We're talking entertainment and more with Mark Prowse. He's a longtime entertainment executive in Las Vegas. Interestingly, and I thought this was fascinating, even though you spent the better part of your childhood there, and maybe you got the bug by seeing showgirls or seeing shows there, you actually physically got into it when you were away at college. Was it in Wyoming?
It was in Wyoming, yeah. As the story goes, I went there to play football for a half a minute, got injured, and that was a good thing. The bottom line was, it comes down to the end of the day, you get focused on some other things when that happens to you. The good thing was I got focused on academics and what my future was about. I've always wanted to be an attorney. That's what I was headed for. I don't know what the hell I was thinking then, but I'm glad I didn't end up there. That would not have been Mark Prowse for sure. I got focused on that. I finally majored in finance, got a minor degree in accounting and did some work in marketing. And I walked up onto a snowy hill one day as I was going to for one of my classes. And I actually had a knee brace on. And a gentleman walked up to me and had a conversation with me about when they were putting the wood dome structure on top of the University of Wyoming arena. And we stood there for a minute and he said, you look like a big guy. I'm by the way, you probably don't know, I'm 6'6" and 270 pounds. So, but then I was, really
rock solid.
I was rock solid. And he said, why don't you like come on board and run security for me? And I said, I know nothing about security. And he goes, that doesn't matter. We'll figure it out together. So his name was Steve Dingman, a really proactive kind of guy. And it just was one of those things that morphed into one thing and then the other. And I did put together marketing programs. I literally would sit at the basketball games when Finis Dembo was there and mixing the sound of the soundboard. And then I would get off the soundboard and go down to the to load in a concert as a stagehand. So I got some really grassroots kind of experience early on in my career.
So you were right there building the whole thing out at the University of Wyoming. Do you remember the first national show or event that you were involved in?
Yeah, Loverboy. And they had the weirdest writer you can possibly imagine. They just to make sure that people were reading writers back in the day. We didn't know what that they were doing to us. We thought really they were playing around. But they were really trying to just make sure that as
somebody's
they
paying attention,
were actually reading the writer, right? So if they show up in their dressing room and they knew that all this weird stuff was there, like peanuts or like M&Ms that were sorted out by the right colors on different trays and stuff like that, they'd request. And specifically Loverboy wanted, colored condoms and that kind of stuff. We just, and so we, as college students, we'd drive ourselves nuts trying to, figure out how to do this. And then, we're dyeing condoms and putting them back in the package. just stupid stuff. But
at the end of the day, you make a great point that the people that are not in the entertainment business don't realize the bands don't really care about that stuff. They just want to make sure that somebody's reading it and that the sound and the lighting is correct. The stage is right. The instruments are right. That other stuff is pretty secondary. They just want to make sure somebody has their eyes on it.
Well, yeah, I think that the other thing that people don't know is that there's actually a couple of things. One of them is that the the business is actually a lot more complicated than it seems. It's the fun business for sure, but there's a lot of operational expertise and planning that go into every single event, even if they're touring events going down the road. The second thing is that related to that, that the production for touring shows is all, you know, rolling down the road for a reason. It's an erector set. They put it together and they're pretty much in control of and responsible for how the sound works in the building and all the balancing. We have very little of that to do with that as a venue. And I guess the second big thing is a lot of people think that it's really simple, but there's a whole business side to entertainment. And it's a lot more complicated than you'd ever think, not only in terms of, you know, when and how they tour, dealing with artists and you know, all the financial elements around that and the contracts and the, you know, insurance and all the stuff that goes with this stuff. It's the fun business, but it's a complicated kind of business model that's been, you know, perpetuated throughout the years.
I know years ago, Mark, I had the opportunity to go backstage for a Rolling Stones show. This was the late 80s, and not to see the Stones, but to see their opening act, Living Color. And it was the first time I realized that something that size, they were touring with an accountant. It was a tour accountant to keep track of the dollars and cents that go on behind the scenes. So I guess that leads to the question, what would, in all the years you've done this, what would surprise people the most about the entertainment business? What do you think they sort of take for granted?
Well, I think I already alluded to it in a nutshell. When an event goes well, there's no real kudos. You know, it's just event went well and they had fun and they want to come back. Your reward is that they want to come back. That not only they had a great experience in your venue, but a lot of it is, you know, the artist as well. I like to equate this to like the PBR, which we were involved in at MGM Grand for a while. And Randy Bernard, who's a really good friend, he coined the phrase of, you know, the rider's only as good as the bull, right? So if the bull sucks, the rider's terrible. Well, by the way, the venues and artists are inextricably intertwined together. In the same way, we're responsible for getting people there and make sure they have a good access, a good experience, a safe experience, and good egress, and you know, those kind of things. But the artists, when they take the stage, it's all up to them at that point. You know, if you have a sound glitch or some of the types of things that happen, like the first people that they point a finger at is the venue, right? They have no idea that all this equipment, 20, 30 trucks has been rolling down the road, and it's their sound guy, it's their sound mix, it's their equipment that they you know, contracted for. And so it's there's heavy dependencies on both sides for touring shows, and it just how complicated that it really is to make an event go well.
You went on to work at the legendary Cow Palace in San Francisco, and came back to Las Vegas to work at the Thomas and Mack Center, which was, you know, that was the venue for the longest time. But then you had an instrumental part in opening an arena that, if folks have never been there, it's difficult to describe, but within the MGM Hotel, there is a massive arena, you know, the size of most Civic Center Coliseums in the rest of the country, and it sits inside this hotel. So it can literally take you a half an hour to walk from your hotel room to your seat in that arena. Tell me about being in on the beginning stages of the MGM arena.
Well, it started with Dennis Finfrock, that was over at UNLV when they brought me in to do sponsorships and marketing back in the day. I'd gone to Tacoma, Washington to run their public assembly facilities. And that's when Dennis, he became the athletic director back in the Tarkanian days. And there's a whole story that everybody wants to pick up. There's a whole podcast you could do on that piece right there.
Right. Sure.
Back in the day, but that's when Tarkanian won the national championship just right after I'd left. So Dennis got caught up in that whole AD thing. And then we ran into each other at a conference, and I knew what he was doing with it when he moved over to MGM. And he said, you know, listen, I'm going to pretty much develop a boxing program, and I'd like for you to come and run the arena. And I said, okay, I'm up for that. And so we worked out the details, and I moved the truck and the camper and everything from Washington to Vegas. We had to finish the building. That was in the middle. That was December 6th of 1992. And in 93, we were opening with Barbra Streisand. We had a whole bunch of the whole boxing program was put together throughout the years. We did a bunch of stuff with Andre Agassi. we signed deals with Ty Murray on the rodeo side, and we had just a ton of things that were ready to execute. When I got there, the building was enclosed, but 15 days we had tremendous pressure to get to Barbra Streisand. And by the way, she had a clause in her contract that said when she took the stage,
right?
I can't disclose, I'm still under an NDA there, how much we paid her, but she would get a refund. We had to pay her all the money and she could walk off the stage and not have to perform.
Get out of here.
Two concerts that were completely sold out at $1,500 a ticket. And we would have had to pay her all the money if she didn't like the venue. Now, you don't think there was a lot of pressure on the few of us that were there to wrangle and get everything done to open that building. That was one of the key touch points that when we got there, she got up on the stage, and a lot of this stuff had to do with Dennis before I was ever there. It was the acoustical design that he'd learned from Thomas and Mac. By the way, the audio was terrible at the day there. They've since done quite a bit of acoustical work in there. But back in the day, he learned about that, and the Grand Garden became a great sound stage by the way it was built, with a lot of flat surfaces and a lot of batting that was put in the roof. And that still to that day, the Billboard Music Awards, you know, the ESPYs, all the other award shows that we've done in there all over the years, that's because of the acoustics in that building. And it was so unique, still is so unique, because it can sound like a wonderful concert venue, but it's also a beautiful sport venue. Like when you would in there for a boxing event, it was amazing how loud it could get during those Tyson days and stuff. It just really bone chilling kind of sound would come in there to create such an amazing event experience.
I was out there in the 90s during the Tyson days, and the numbers that I heard when I lived there is that when he was in town fighting, that the population of Las Vegas would grow by 250,000 people. And I've always found it fascinating that folks like you would be able to figure out how to funnel that many bodies through an area, you know, through and into the MGM Grand Garden to have a pleasant experience. And there's just a whole ton of sort of logistics work that go into that.
Well, there is, and I'm certainly not going to sit here and tell you that I take credit for everything that happened. It takes a small army, as it does to run all of Las Vegas, but a small battalion, if you will, in MGM Grand to really put on those major events. Now, that's the impact. And by the way, 250,000 people in some of these events is probably a very small estimated impact. There was probably a lot more people came in for that just because of the ambience in the city would actually change dramatically around these major events.
Right.
They're not just boxing. I mean, there's a lot of other things. We could do Rolling Stones events. We would do a Streisand. People would come in just to be a part of the ambience in the city. Of course, they want to be at the epicenter where the event's happening, which means you have to plan around a lot of safety and security things, access things, of which create a lot of vulnerabilities. You know, when the Tupac Secure thing happens, it was right after one of our events. That shows what can happen when nothing really happens, but you have the appearance that something happened, and it changes the whole dynamic of the crowd and what happens in the venue. So we planned through a lot of things. We learned through a lot of things, no question. But the major events were all of our executive team. We had about 15 people on our executive committee, from food and beverage to hotel operations to whatever. They were all part of the solution for our events.
At that time, I'll tell you my favorite memory of the MGM Garden, the Grand Garden. I saw James Taylor there, saw Eric Clapton, but the Billboard Music Awards happened in 1998 there. And I had just gotten our radio station, KMZQ, to number one in the ratings as a program director. And we brought all the corporate brass in, and we went to the arena to the show. And this is when the boy bands were huge. And so I got in a limousine for all the corporate guys from CBS and all our DJs to come in. And right in front of us was NSYNC in the limo. So the limo pulls up with NSYNC and everybody gets out and they snap their photos and very excited. The next limo pulls up and it's a bunch of us schleppy DJs. We get out and the cameras just go, No interest at all. Mark Prowse, our guest today, we're talking about legendary Las Vegas. At that time, too, Mark, there was a big push on, and didn't last long, I think it ended while I was there, to make Las Vegas a family destination.
Oh, yeah.
Lots of that happening. I remember Caesar's Palace did a magic experience downstairs, and you know, there was all of that happening. Was that a bad move in retrospect? Is there a place for family entertainment now in Las Vegas, now that it's double the size, or is this a place for grown-up fun?
Well, I have my opinion on that, and there's probably some factual data around that, but I'll give you my opinion because I think that's probably what you're asking for, the most relevant. There has been millions and millions of dollars, if not billions of dollars, that have been gone into the development of Vegas and what it really is and what it needs to be. There was a thought early on, and by the way, we had a theme park at MGM Grand
yes.
when we opened, of which Felix Rappaport was there and running that piece of it. And, you know, I call it a theme-et park-et. It was not really a theme park because it was like, I mean, what theme park's going to be, trapped by the amount of real estate they have, but we were completely trapped. The only thing you do is change a few of the rides here and there, but you couldn't grow rides like, Disney and the others do. So at the end of the day, it opened up and it was fun and we had a lot of fanfare around it. There was a lot of people that thought that was the advent of things. And by the way, there was empirical data that told Las Vegas and these smart people that this would be a good thing to grow the demographic of Las Vegas. Look at the way that Excalibur was designed and still right. is designed. You know, look at Circus Circus and the way it was designed and still is designed and has, you know, the Adventure Dome there. Look at the roller coaster at New York, New York. There is something for everyone here, but the shift that you've seen over the years, and specifically since the early 90s, has shown that this really is an adult playground. It really is a place for people to, listen, if you want to bring your families, it can be safe, fun, secure. There's things for the kids to do, but it's not going to become Orlando and it's not going to become Anaheim and those kind of things. It just, nobody's spending money to go and do that anymore. It's all about what I said. It's about family environments, welcome. But it's really an adult playground. That's where the money is. That's where the fun is.
And there was something of a stigma, right or wrong, with entertainers for years. Well, you know, Las Vegas is where you go for your career to die. But now, the hottest and the biggest entertainers in the world, not just in America, Las Vegas is a must-to destination. And as a guy who won the Entertainment Icon Legend Award, you probably had something to do with that. What was the shift, and how conscious was that to make Las Vegas, you know, the place to be as opposed to the place you don't want to be as an entertainer?
Well, I'm gonna call out a few people here because again, this is a teamwork effort and a visionary effort. A gentleman by the name of Tim Lewicki, who was the president of AEG back in the late 90s and all the way through 2000, I believe, who's now the chairman of Oakview Management Group, OVG, which is going to build another arena here in town, by the way. This is how visionary this guy is. I remember the day that he came to me and said, I'd like to pitch something to you guys. I said, okay. He said, and I want Richard Sturm there. Richard Sturm is our president of entertainment. And I said, okay. And he was my boss. So I said, I set the meeting up and Tim Lewicki comes in and he said, I want to build a theater. And I want to do it here at MGM because of our relationship. And I want to bring an artist here that I want to run by you. And I think it's iconic and we need to pay her well over $100 million to do this gig. And Richard and I looked at each other and went, so how does the venue get built and how do you cover the $100 million? And he goes, we'll cover the $100 million, but we need you to build the venue. And it needs to be at least, 6,000-7,000 seats for us to run the pro forma on it. I said, wow. Okay, so that's big. And by the way, if you don't know, even after we got rid of the theme park, a lot of that stuff became a conference center, and we'd already done some planning on putting Signature Towers there. So we were ground locked. We didn't have a theater that made made sense to do that. And by the way, that was another $100 million, by the way. So we looked at Tim and said, Tim, you know, we're just not ready for that. We're not able to do that right now. We don't think we can get that through. But incidentally, who is the artist? And he said, Celine Dion. And we went, interesting. He said, what do you think of that? Do you think that I can cover my nut? We're really be out on the outside edge of this whole thing. And I said, well, if you picked any one songbird on the planet that could probably cover this, you picked the right one.
That's right.
She really wants to sit down and do this because of the graveyard effect in Vegas and whatever. And she said, yes. And there's a lot of personal reasons too. And at that time we didn't know that her husband was sick. But at the same time, it came down to where they bridged all the stuff and they go over to Caesars and Caesars bit off on it. And of course the rest of it's all history.
Sure.
So that advent of Celine Dion
was that the tipping point?
Pivotal moment. Cause everyone was watching to see how this happened. And kudos to Caesars because, you know, all tides float all boats, right? We want Caesars to be successful, even though they've done amazing things. We've done amazing things. What you don't want to see is a Fountain Blue project happen, right?
Right.
That just gets up high in the sky and it's a ghost forever. Now, thank God our dear friend, is over there. Cliff Atkins is going to do a great job delivering that product back to this market, but you never want to see that happen. So we were all watching this one thing and it watched for years. And when it was so highly successful, all you want to do is replicate it. And by the way, the whole business side of the industry followed behind it. Agents, managers, artists, every single thing started going, their ears perked up and they went, maybe I don't have to tour so hard. And by the way, touring is not cheap. You know,
right.
All the buses, all the equipment, all the crap rolling down the road, all the buildings you got to line up and all this stuff that happens to do a tour, they're going, we don't have to be, you know, archaic artists that are sunsetting here and coming to Vegas to die. And so that started the whole conversation around us building a theater, which is became the Park Theater. Then we started delivering, amazing artists. Again, that by that time we'd gotten organized as a corporation where I became the senior vice president of entertainment operations. Chris Baldazon became the senior vice president of booking, and working with Richard Sturm, they're the ones that actually created the actual artist deals. I had to deliver the venue. I had to deliver the, by the way, when you get into residencies and people and your artist is physically living there with you for those period of times, it's a whole different operational mode than it is for to accommodate the arena type environment and so on and so forth.
What's the big difference there? If Britney Spears sits down in Las Vegas or whoever sits down there, what's the big seismic shift?
Well, the first piece of it is you have an artist who has experienced a tremendous amount of variety, good and bad, on the road. They have a lot of people around them that have honed into how to make them comfortable and how to not only artistically, but physically, and their families and all the people that come with and around them. We deal with that on an occasional basis when you're doing touring type shows and arenas and things like that. But when you physically have a resident artist there, the challenge is to make them feel like this is their home. And in the Caesars Palace situation for Celine, they literally built her a 2,000 square foot apartment down there. She lived there. Right. Well, we didn't have that kind of space to do that for the Park Theater, but we needed to be able to do that for right. our other residencies. So then it became the connectivity to the hotel. How do we move them through the hotel? How do we make this suite, that nice suite that they have there, theirs, and their entourages and their management, theirs for the time that they're there. And it's not only just the feeding and care; it's literally that physical environment. And then making sure when they take the stage that everything there is theirs. We modified the venue on many occasions for Lady Gaga and for other artists that would be there just to change the full sound system. And then after that full sound system was done, we'd have to take it back out to turn it into a touring venue and some of the other things we were doing there. So yeah, it's very, very different from the arena environment.
And DJs are a new addition to the Las Vegas landscape. DJs have gotten really popular, really big, and And I wonder if you could speak to that piece and how that's different than it was even 10 years ago.
Well, again, I think you have to give quite a few people some credit in this. The Wynn, Steve Wynn and his team there, Sean Christie, most notably, was amazing in the way that they created a lot of the DJ nightclub kind of environments. We had led the way by putting Wet Republic in, which is a day club. And then, it turned into, something that really helped to spur some of that thought that Sean Christie had done with the Wynn back then. We had Studio 54 in MGM, and I was the vice president of entertainment then. Scott Sabella came in as the new president, and he's now running Resorts World. By the way, if you don't know Scott is an amazing thinker in terms of the way he thinks of things. He came in, went through, and he came and met with me, and he said, "So what are we doing?" I updated him. What are your ideas? And then he said, "By the way, I met with everybody else, and you were last. The reason why you're last is because we're going to change more in this building around your space than any of the other vice presidents that we have." I said, "Okay." And he goes, "So fasten your seatbelt. I hope you're in for this." So literally the next week he pulls me in and he said, "We're taking out Studio 54. I got buy-in from corporate. I need you to put out an RFP and we need to figure out how to compete with Wynn." I'm like, "Okay."
That's fast. So
we drafted an RFP very quickly and put it out there. And of course we got five or six really, really good responses. And one of them was from the Light Group and Angel Management was one of them that we chose, and Angel Management basically had come up with a concept that they wanted to team up with the Sheikh in Abu Dhabi or in Dubai, and basically it was like they wanted to create this Hakkasan brand, and the pitch was nothing short of amazing. I mean, they had done I still got it at my house, by the way. It was a big plastic box, and it had all kinds of thumb drives, and it was an amazing pitch. And we just went, okay. And now we know you got the money too. So, but then when we got into the detail and figured out the design, had to rip the whole front of the building off. It's the first time we'd ever breached the outside of the building to build a club. We went from 30,000 square feet in Studio 54 to 90,000 square feet with Hakkasan. Not only going up and out, and then that's when the new lion was put on the front. But that was a big part of our transformation into that. Hakkasan, since then went on to build other things, and then Tao became a big thing in Venetian. But we led the way with Hakkasan because that's when we ratcheted up the artist. An artist would play for $250,000 in Wet Republic, and then come and play at Hakkasan for $250,000 more at night. So $500,000 with putting your computer down and exploiting your brand.
And pressing a few buttons here and there.
Wow. After all the stuff we'd done in all the arenas, for some artist to walk out for $500,000, after all the expenses and all the touring and all the other stuff, and these guys walk in with a thumb drive and stick it into a CDC and make $500,000 net.
We may be in the wrong business, Mark.
Oh, it still is absolutely amazing to me, and it's insane. But I love the DJs that have made this a good punch in the arm for the city.
Mark Prowse, our guest today, winner of the prestigious Entertainment Icon Legend Award for his many years of contributions to Las Vegas. That city now has way more competition than it did when I lived there. There's gambling across 30 some states now. And yet Las Vegas maintains sort of the premium spot. How do you do that? How do you compete not only with Atlantic City and with Branson, but everywhere else that has gambling and entertainment?
So it's all about the mirage, right? That's known as the desert. It's creating that vision for people that it's bigger than life. And part of that's happened over the history of time, but the challenge is always to one-upsmanship. It's always to create the bigger or better mousetrap, if you want to, from a business perspective. but it's literally about the breadth, but more importantly, the depth. The breadth is really the demographic. The depth is about the content. It's about these billions of dollars that we spend on resorts that are not only beautiful, but they perform really, really well. I mean, you'll notice that the last few resorts that have been built, they're all formed in the form of an X. So they have a central corridor that runs the hotel to a great degree. That's huge efficiency in terms of how that works. But they learned from skyscrapers and other parts of the areas. But it's amazing to think about the learnings that have happened over time. One of the things we learned was we're nothing without our events. It has to be, they create this exposure outside of the walls of Vegas, the walls of this valley that keep it relevant. Look at all what's happening in the sports category right now, which we're proud to say building the T-Mobile Arena started this whole thing. It showed the advent that a pro sports team, hockey, that is not the number one in pro sports, could knock it out of the park. It got everybody's attention.
Sure.
And by the way, I'm sure NBA will be here too. But then when you have Allegiant Stadium after T-Mobile Arena, you have Allegiant Stadium, and you have, you know, all the soccer teams that are here now. You probably soon have the NBA. The key to the whole thing is to have people pivot on us that are international communities like F1. You know how big that is? F1's coming to Vegas. The first thing that Dennis Finfrock had Darren Lebanati and I working on when we first got here was how to bring an F1 race to Vegas. And by the time we got into the detail of that, what roads had to be closed off, all the people that had to buy into it, Vegas wasn't ready. Any more than Vegas wasn't ready for an NHL team until we got to, you know, 2015, 2016. It wasn't ready. Now it's ready. It's ready to take the pain to get the game to close. You know, it takes 2 weeks at a minimum, if not a full month, to build a track for F1.
Wow.
I mean, you can imagine the buildings that are being surrounded that just on race day, that they are small cities, that all the food and equipment that has to come into every one of those resorts on a day-to-day basis. That's what stopped us back in 1994, 95. We couldn't get Caesars or anybody else to agree that we would block down. They didn't want the logistics. They're like, it's not worth it. We're not doing it.
So, and you know, if you do travel internationally, I just got back from a trip to Dubai, and you see, you talk about the international flavor. Las Vegas has really become an international city on a level with, we're exceeding places like Dubai through the hard work of all the Mark Prowls of the world that are behind the scenes. And there is a legion of you gentlemen and ladies that put all that together. I do have to ask you, because you touched on it earlier, Mark, when things go wrong in your business, like they went wrong in Houston with that Travis Scott show, when you had the shooting there in Las Vegas, is that the worst day of a venue operator's life when things go seriously wrong? And how do you recover from that?
Yeah. Sorry. That one still chokes me up. Because, yeah, it was the worst day of my job. The worst. I mean, of course, I was there. I just come from a hockey game. Darren Lebanati was my vice president of outdoor operations. And, you know, I'm telling you, that shows that you got to be on your game. And there's nobody on their game like Darren Lebanati and the team that he built there.
No way to predict something like
No, but if he hadn't have done so many of the things that he did, it could have been a lot worse in setting up the venue and executing, you know, the plan. Because seeing it there, and I can tell you my personal experience, but at the end of the day, I know that so many more lives would have been lost from trampling and other types of things, aside from the shooting. If we had to done the right things, but you know, it's just, yeah, that was the worst nightmare you could ever dream would happen in the course of your career. And you know, what's weird about that whole thing was And I accepted the Icon Award days after that, on the 20th of October. So days after that, and Bill Hornbuckle, our president, was going to accept, you know, present the award to me. And I remember him calling me and saying, are you up for this? And I'm like, I'm going to do my best. That's all I can tell you. Because we were still in the aftermath of a lot of stuff. They locked down the venue for months after that with the FBI. And there was just a lot of stuff that happened with it. Still a lot of emotion. And you can tell still a lot of emotion build up in me.
Sure.
Over all those years. It's just, you know, the lives that affected through one crazy person. And what is still happening with all the mass shootings in Vegas? The answer to me, and I'm sorry to get a little bit political here, but I have to.
Okay.
I guess it's just, I'm a big outdoorsman. You know, I hunt, I you know, own guns. And I believe this with all of my heart. Something we got to get in the fabric of our society and figure out, all these video games or the virtual realities that we're dealing with or whatever that are getting these kids to think about these copycat things or take out their fears, angers, or, you know, mental diseases on. Guns don't kill people. People kill people. And the minute we start to figure out how to get into the psyche of access is one thing, to guns and those kind of things. But the other part of it has to do with just, you know, getting into the core of a fabric of who we are as Americans, to respect life, to love each other, and to help the people that are struggling. That's what really came out of this to me, is that, you know, was I ever looking up in any of the events that I planned, all the outdoor festivals that I've done, all of the pre-events outside the arena? Was I ever looking up? This one taught me to look up and around and everything else and realize, and it taught Metro and everybody else the same thing. Every event we put on from there, we all had high point security. You know, we haven't even gotten into the other parts of technology that are their vulnerabilities, like drones.
Right.
And other types of airstrikes that can happen. I mean, we can't live our lives like this as Americans, but as event planners, we have to make sure we're spending the money to do the right things for that safety and security. It's a very fine line that we walk. When people don't feel safe, they're not coming out.
And you're in the bring people together business, you know, to enjoy themselves. I'm not going to ask you, Mark. I'm not going to ask you to relive that horrible day. I had friends that were there too, but I knew that had to be, if not the worst, one of the worst days for anybody who does what you do for a living. So let's end on a happy note. Let's talk about your favorite artist that you've worked with.
Oh, hands down, Garth Brooks. I mean,
what a great guy.
No, it's just, I can tell you Garth stories going back to Tacoma Dome days. Back when he was nobody. And I told this story to him when we were getting him to come to T-Mobile Arena as part of our opening sequence. Chris Baldezon and I flew to Nashville and sat there with him. And I said, I know we know each other, but I never told you this story and I need to go back. And he goes, go. And I said, and we're sitting in his agent's office, and he just got off his tractor, and he came in there, and he's in overalls with mud on his boots. It's just the way Garth is, right? And I said, well, you know, back in the early 90s, I was at Tacoma Dome, and you remember we were doing the sleepovers, you know, when we were doing because we didn't have very good electronic ticketing back then. So we had the lines, whatever. So instead, then
people would camp out outside.
Yeah. So we brought them inside the Tacoma Dome and we let them sleep. We did a sleepover. And so Garth embraced those kind of things. Just amazing the way he would think. He's a marketer at heart, but he just loves people. He got to a place where bring the people inside your venues. Let's make a media event out of it. So we'd bring in the radio stations and they'd interview these people all night long, and just the crescendo would build and build and build until we get to 8 o'clock the next morning when we'd have the advent of ticket sales. Garth would go on the phone to every single one of the outlets. And I was the one that was conducting that on our end with Garth. And I was reminding him of when we did that thing at Tacoma, and we had several thousand people because the floor was so big. And so he just laughed. I mean, like, he's like, oh yeah, that's a great walk in memory lane. And so we connect on a bunch of those kind of things. Matter of fact, I just went to a show, at, Allegiant, where he's doing a private event for State Farm. And over all these years, you will never change guard. When he puts that microphone in his hand and stands up on stage, the human being that he is in life transcends everything else that comes out of his body. And it's infectious, absolutely infectious. There's a lot of artists like that. There's no question about that. But in terms of the way, because I'm just a big country guy, it just always, and especially now seeing after all these years, seeing how that's still the root of him.
If you looked up on that stage, a lot of the musicians around him are guys that have been with him since he was doing county fairs in the 80s.
Yeah.
Such a loyal guy. You're right.
The other part of that story that I told him at Tacoma Dome was that I was in charge of booking as well. So we go to Nashville and they had a conference there. And part of that conference was that they would do these showcases. So they're up and new and coming artists and stuff like that. Well, I'd walked out of one of the showcases and I'm standing in the line for the bar, which is 5 miles long. And there's one bartender. And I'm like, can you believe this? I mean, they couldn't put another bartender on. And I turned around and I said, I'm talking to the guy in back of me. And he goes, yeah, I know. And he said, I've only got a small amount of time. I got to get back. And I said, get back to what? And he said, I'm next. I'm on stage. And I said, really? So what's your name? And he goes, Garth Brooks. That's how I first met Garth.
Wow.
Yeah.
I love it. So you now do something that's pretty interesting in terms of helping people to be able to capture those special moments in their lives. And I tell a lot of the entertainers that I work with, you know, your 30-second interaction with someone is just another, you know, stop in the road for you, but that's a lifetime memory for the person that meets you. It's a lifetime memory for someone to go to a concert or a sporting event. Sometimes it's a once in a lifetime memory. And you're making sure that those don't get missed with this new thing that you're introducing to arenas so folks can stay charged up with their mobile devices. That's changed the whole game. Everyone now has that phone up and they're videoing these events. So talk to me a little bit about that initiative before I let you jump.
Well, let me tell you how this came to be. After being there in MGM Resorts 27 years, through all those amazing experiences, I got a call on May 2nd of 2020 telling me that the company was making a shift. And on that day, I think they let 42 executives go. Many of my very dear friends had been there a long time, and longer story around that. But at the end of the day, that was the end of it. Now I'll tell you that the company took really good care of me in that exit plan, and I was fine with it.
And that was because, for people who are listening, the entertainment industry completely shut down.
Shut down.
COVID.
Shut down.
Not 80%, not 90%, 100%.
Yeah.
So everybody was out of work at all levels.
You know, and I don't know what vision the company had back in that day, but in 2019, it actually enacted a plan called MGM 2020. Which was a program to restructure the company. And so we just finished that whole plan. We were into it for less than a year, or a little over a year. And so we have already skinny down a lot. I was then given a directive in March to take it down to critical only entertainment employees because of what you said. And then it got to the end of the day where, they had to go farther and they went to senior level executives. But so for the next year or so, I basically ramped up my consulting company and did a few of those things. I got bored, frankly. I mean, I needed more. I could hardly wait for the economy to open. There was this fits and starts and stops, and as we all know. And then when we got to like October of last year, the offers started coming in. I mean, I was talking to ASM Global about a key project here in Vegas. We were talking to legends and a number of other people. And then I went to a hockey game in October and met up with Chris Meyer, who's a good friend of mine that was the VP of business development for the convention center, who had left and is now doing his own thing. And basically he said, I need you to come over to the house and have dinner and then we'll talk about what's next. So he mentioned June Zhu to me with Charger Go-Go. And she was looking for a chief operating officer. Well, I've had all these things in front of me and I'm looking at them and I'm going like, do I want to do this? Do I want to do that? Pretty much the venue management business again. Or in the twilight of my career, do I want to take the big gamble, the big Vegas gamble, if you will? So I went over and met with June in early December and found her extremely brilliant and compelling. And I fell in love with the product. The product, in short, is a vending machine that dispenses fully charged, fully mobile batteries for you to be able to continue to enjoy your phone or your device, you know, while you're still completely on the go. Hence the charger go-go part of it. And so it's an IoT device that basically allows us to be able to control the device. It allows us to be able to get the financial, the metrics from it financially or the empirical data from it. And it most importantly, it solves a serious guest pain of, you know, battery level anxiety. I, being in the entertainment business, I immediately got it because there's so many times I'd be working events that, yes, of course, my office is right there. What am I going to do? Go plug my phone in over there while it gets another charge? And I literally would have to plan those times in my event planning life,
right?
To make sure I had a full charge. Now, I wasn't even using high social media then, and no major Zoom calls. You know, we're not talking about all the things that drain your battery quicker. Now you have them where they're crazy. So I immediately pivoted on this space, not only because I could have maybe a really good payday on the end of it, because it was so different. It was so tangential and strongly tangential to my entertainment contacts and experience that I knew that I could be a creative to help grow this company exponentially the way it would need to hopefully get some investors' eyes to really light up. And I can tell you, Burke, this has been one of the most amazing rides over the last seven months with the growth of this company and the advent of what we're doing. We're in a lot of key accounts, major venues. We're in the convention center here. We're now in 25 states after a few months. We now have a lot of distributors that are bringing the unit on board. And we're just super excited to continue to grow this company and this space.
If someone is interested in Charger Go-Go, what's the website and where can they find out more about maybe putting one of these devices in their facility? How can they find you?
So chargergogo.com, to our website, is the best place to go. It'll lead you to a whole bunch of other places, including how the unit works. It gives you a demo of how it works, what it's all about. We're also on Facebook, LinkedIn, and TikTok. Matter of fact, one of my guys that works for me just posted on TikTok the other day. You got to go on and see this short video they did. It's pretty fun. But at the end of the day, it shows how you can have fun with the product too. But that's the best place to go to really get the head end of all the things we do. At the end of the day, we place the units for free as on consignment to businesses and revenue share 30% with them on a consignment model. So there's no money out of pocket and we rev share with you. On the other side, if you want to go deeper with us, that's a distributor model, you can actually buy in the units on a wholesale basis. You know, we give a special pricing on those where you can literally buy a lot of units for anywhere from $5,000 to $50,000 and run your own business. And the rev share model on those, it flips around where now you make 70 to 80% of the revenue on those. So we have a model for pretty much anybody that wants to go. And the great part about the distributor model is very much like a franchise, but without having a specific demographic that you have ownership with, but you can grow it very, very quickly. When you realize the different places you can go where your battery goes dead, your mind will start to bug you to death. That's what I did to Mike Enoch, by the way, that put us together, a very dear friend.
Yes.
And then we got him a device and now he's running around with it like it's a newborn child under his arm going like, look at this thing, look at this thing. Because it really is exciting. It's just one of those kind of things that I think that you're going to be reading about us in a few short months. By the way, I want to tease this because I think we're really close to this. So I'm sorry, John Taffer, if I'm spilling the beans, but if you know John Taffer with Bar Rescue, We're having great conversations with them around some things that we want to do. By the time this actually airs, we'll know where we're going with them, by the way.
Good.
So just look for the next Bar Rescue, and you'll see those kind of things coming out to show not only how ancillary revenue and can help save businesses. And when they start thinking out of the box this way, that's why John loves this, is because when the first thing he goes into a bar to teach people to manage the bar is turn over every rock, find every revenue stream, no matter how small, and make it a great guest experience. We are in a digital society. People will always need to be stay charged up. And I'm going to leave you with these thoughts here from my dear brother, Dale.
Yeah.
Working for a company in Nikola, in Arizona. Nikola is a large vehicle manufacturer that do dump trucks and long travel vehicles. And he's in charge of the battery distribution for them. So who do I call before I decide to do this? I called Dale up and I said, Dale, tell me about startups. So he gave me startup 101 education. And then I said, tell me about batteries. And I said, I'm concerned that if I pivot on this space, I'll get to a place where all of a sudden they'll come up with a new battery technology that will people's phones will last forever. And he started laughing and he goes, ha, that ain't going to happen in my lifetime or yours. And by the way, he's my younger brother. And he said, because like if Elon Musk wanted to pivot on this space to make Tesla's lighter or some other thing, he wouldn't have done SpaceX. He wouldn't have done the Boring Company. He wouldn't have been doing the other stuff. He would have pivoted and put billions of dollars into the space. Same thing with Apple. I mean, they sell millions of batteries in phones when they replace them. They're going to make and by the way, battery phones are bigger now than they were getting smaller, smaller, smaller. Now they're getting bigger and bigger, bigger.
Go the other direction. That's right.
Which means they don't need to like compress the batteries and go into battery technology development kind of things. I said, thank you for that. I'm going to take the job. I'll call you back later. So that's kind of the way this whole thing worked. And I think at the end of the day, this is going to be not only a very necessary space, but it's a fun space. We're in festivals, we're in events and arenas, we're in McDonald's, we're in all these places. And we put them in fully deployment. Shout out to my dear friend Cynthia Kaiser Murphy. She fully deployed the Palms before it reopened.
Very good.
And we're just deploying Yamava Casino down in California. Which is a parent company to the company that bought the Palms. And we're unfortunately in a whole bunch of procurement processes with MGM Resorts and other places. So those will take a little bit longer, but you'll see them everywhere is the net result.
When you see the Charger Go-Go machines, you'll know the guy that is behind the whole thing.
You won't have to worry about walking out with that battery charger. And you won't have to worry about whether you got your cord on you. You just can get a Charger Go-Go.
One last question.
Yeah.
Fascinating conversation. If someone looks at Mark Prowse and says, man, I'd like to have a career like that, what piece of advice would you give them?
Well, I've mentored a lot of people. Matter of fact, I've had a tremendous, I hope my mentees actually listen to quite a bit of this because they've inspired me over all the years. Dennis Finfrock taught all of us this. And he's really the godfather to entertainment here in Vegas. Literally, you can go to any of the places, Darren Lebanotti to, Steve Stallworth to any of the places around here. We're all still here. Pat Christensen, that's the president of Las Vegas Events. He was the granddaddy to all of us there. But he taught us all to be very, very grateful for what we've attained, but give back. He was the president of IAVM, which is the International Association of Venue Managers. And that was one of his monikers that he taught was give back, give back. So I literally had 20 mentors in some years where I would literally spend tons of time with people to be able to tell them how to craft their career and how to steer through it. And many of them have been highly successful. But I just want to say that I think that for the young people coming out of college, grab onto an internship wherever you can, paid or unpaid. Be dogged about it. It's really, really tough to get into this business. I don't care if you're talking about on the artist side or the agency side. I don't care if you're talking about with a professional sports team, I'll highly note professional sports teams, by the way, very, very, very difficult to get into those, more so than even the facility management piece. But do your internships, you pay your dues, start when you're a sophomore or junior, be directional. Don't be all over the map. Show them your passion. Make sure that they know that this is not just a fly by night thing because you like to watch baseball, you know, or right. you played soccer somewhere, or you know, happen to like music. It's because you've done your homework and you know the tenets of what you're looking for out of your internship. And when you do that, and work hard, because that I'm telling you, there this millennial moniker that's been put over top of things have given a bad taste in a lot of hiring people's mouths, because it's like we want something for nothing kind of thing, and the people that have actually broken out of that have shown that they have hard work and desire and drive and focus will break through those kind of things and build an amazing career like I've had.
And you have indeed. Mark Prowse is a legend in Las Vegas, and we had a great opportunity to spend time with him. Check out his new company, ChargerGoGo.com, and you can find out more about how you can stay charged 100%. And I 100% thank you for spending time with me today.
It's my pleasure, Burke. Thank you.
The Big Time Talker podcast brought to you by SpeakerMatch.com. Wherever you go, whatever you do today, be kind to one another. Make it a great day. Thanks for listening. Bye, everybody.